Welcome to the Reason Roundtable, your weekly libertarian podcast, where grooming is something that only happens to extremely large dogs. I am Matt Welch, joined by Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and subbing in for Catherine Mangue Ward, none other than our newish assistant editor, Fiona Harrigan. Please clap. Hello, everybody, and especially Fiona.
Hey, Matt.
Hello.
Happy Monday.
So there's, well, even before any of this, I just want to say for you 160 or so listeners who we saw at the Reason Weekend conference in Nashville, I was just tremendous. We did a live show there that was posted on Friday. But like so many people listened to this thing very, very closely and were giving feedback on possible future cultural recommendations at the end of the show. It was just very lovely to hear how closely everyone's listening. And I don't know if Nick and Peter want to add to my sense of gratitude towards those lovely people.
It was a great event.
It was a great event, and it was great to meet listeners and get to hear, get to know them a little bit, right? Because it wasn't just sort of 1 hour and then a little bit of meet and greet afterwards. It was that we spent the whole weekend there and getting to know some of the listeners and understand their relationship with the show. It's just really gratifying. And so thank you to everyone who attended. And also thank you to all the listeners who give us an hour of your mind every week.
They're the real stars.
Mm-hmm. They're the real Americans. All right. So speaking of Americans, there are big piles of news coming out of Ukraine. Does that transition make sense? No. Russia is resetting its military campaign as we speak, preparing for an all-out battle in the eastern regions of the country, especially in the Donbass. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky is continuing his nonstop media barnstorming tour, most recently on last night's 60 Minutes broadcast, where he said, quote, "It will be hard, very hard for us to hold on," end quote, especially in the besieged and beleaguered city of Mariupol, where they are facing what looks like a last stand type of operation. Zelensky also described scenes in cities like Bucha as, quote, "death, just death," where Russians retreats leave behind evidence of horrific, horrific scenes of civilian murder. Such discoveries are increasing discussion, including by Ilya Soman at our sister publication, The Volo Conspiracy, of possible war crimes tribunals being brought against Vladimir Putin and various Ruskies. Nick, let's start there. There are pros and cons to launching war crimes prosecutions. In any case, now we're also in the case in the middle of a war. So what side do you land on about the wisdom of such a thing, particularly right now?
I don't think, starting a war crime tribunal, I don't know exactly what that would mean to do during hostilities. I think it should be something that is, absolutely considered, once the hostilities cease. It doesn't make a lot of sense to me right now. And, while the recognizing war crimes and punishing people, whether it's through the UN or in The Hague, is, I think, is an important act. It goes beyond symbolism. It's really not something that should be the focus of a lot of conversation right now. I think it's more important that NATO and European countries actually figure out how to assist Ukraine and how to end the hostilities, which may also include a negotiated settlement. And I don't think that threatening Putin with war crimes is necessarily going to add to that very much.
That whole assisting Ukraine and ending hostilities leads to a question, Suderman, which is, does assisting Ukraine help lead to the end of hostilities? There's a lot of debate over whether sending more arms into the country, which obviously Zelensky is asking for in every single breath that he takes, and the Western and Western Europe and Western countries seem to be more inclined to do in the face of all these atrocities. There's an argument that that's the best way to deal with Russian aggression and get to a negotiating table. And there's also the argument that might be more copacetic to your nuke-fearing ears that just escalates the possibility of World War III or IV. What do you think, Peter?
Well, it seems like there's two pretty obvious competing imperatives here for the You know, there's just the fact that Russia is in the wrong. Is very obviously in the wrong based on international law, based on sort of any moral principle that you can come up with, based on like sort of core libertarian values and ideals, right? Russia is out there invading another country's territory. This is a war of choice. They're killing civilians as well, like as part of this. It's just, it's all bad. Vladimir Putin, bad. Russia waging war in Ukraine, very bad. And ideally you would want to stop that. And then the question is, can you? What can you do to actually stop that? And at the same time that you're trying to stop that, you also want to make sure that you don't even just a little raise the meaning, like the real risk of nuclear exchange with Russia, which has, you know, thousands and thousands of nuclear weapons stockpiled. And, you know, occasionally, as I've noted on this podcast before, has, you know, state propagandist TV anchors say things like, well, you know, we've just got enough nukes that we could turn the West into like an irradiated ash pile, which is more or less true. And we don't want to happen. And so my answer, Matt Welch, is how the hell should I know? How the hell should I know? I do not actually know. It is incredibly heartening to see that Ukraine is fighting back and coming as close as you could possibly expect to basically winning this war. I'm not saying they actually are winning, and it's very difficult to tell in real time, but they seem to have repelled the Russian invasion in ways that we weren't expecting and have pushed them back just towards the east, towards the border with Russia. At the same time, nuclear war. Nuclear war that is the absolute worst thing that you could imagine. It's so much more horrific even than the truly, truly like heartbreaking, awful, you know, humanitarian catastrophe style scenes that we have already seen. And avoiding nuclear war has to be the top imperative for the United States and for the West in general.
Peter, as someone who lived through the 80s version of the band Starship, I'm not sure that we have seen anything that can be worse than that. Fiona, 3 weeks ago, you wrote a great piece about how the American media seems to be kind of agitating for a more interventionist style policy and kind of browbeating politicians in that direction. Since then, how would you assess both that aspect of American media coverage and then also just kind of the treatment of Zelensky himself?
Yeah, you know, I think in a sense, Zelensky has painted himself as this, you know, he's a very sympathetic figure. And I think he knows it very clearly in the way that he is appealing for your Western assistance and U.S. assistance specifically. And I keep turning over in my mind these questions of, you know, extension of the conflict versus U.S. involvement and how those are interrelated and what exactly, you know, is going to emerge from those two things. And I think him being so sympathetic, there's kind of this supposition that we should be assisting, right? That we should be doing something. And now that we're in the throes of conflict, it's harder to have those debates, right, over what that should look like necessarily. And thinking about U.S. involvement, you know, I'm concerned at what point Russia is going to say that the U.S. is implicated, that it's a co-combatant in a sense, right?
I mean, to some extent, they are already, they haven't said that in a really official way, but they have already suggested that, like, they kind of, they feel that. It's not like they're unaware of what we're doing, right? They're, right. They know that we are sending the Ukrainians, anti-tank missiles, and that the Ukrainians are winning at least in part because of Western assistance.
Right. And, you know, there are gradations of our involvement in the conflict, whether it's a vigilante American hacker, right, taking down cyber infrastructure, whether it's a, you know, a volunteer fighter in the Ukrainian army, or whether it's these huge packages of arms deals. You know, at what point does that look like actual conflict to the Russian eye? And I think I'm concerned about that, and I'm especially concerned over how much the U.S. media seems to be agitating for certain things. And Matt, you kind of refer to that, but you know, you see these press conferences of journalists saying, you know, why won't we impose a no-fly zone? Why is that something the administration has decided against? And they're painting it almost as, you know, pushing the president in a tough, hard-ass way, in a sense, but It reads more as interventionism and as hunger for conflict, you know, to their eye as something that is worth conflict over, but to something that would have very catastrophic implications if it goes in the way that, you know, it looks like it might.
Nick, there's underlying all of this, this all dates back to 1994, when Ukraine agreed to give up its nuclear weapons in exchange for some amount of signed guarantees over we won't invade you and we'll respect your borders, both from Russia and also from the US and the UK. And now we can see what happens when you give up your nukes. But that's not the only time that we've seen what happens when you give up your nukes. That also happened in Libya. And the country that made them pay for that was the United States, which overthrew a regime there. So how do you balance, if you even do that, you know, Peter's concern over impending nuclear war with, like, we two countries now have just demonstrated to the world that the thing that you want more than anything else is to have nukes.
Well, you know, I would put it slightly differently, and I would say that, you know, at least since the end of the Cold War, the United States has shown itself to be one of the worst allies that you can, you know, make peace with. You know, it also with Saddam Hussein in Iraq, but certainly with Gaddafi in Libya, Mubarak in Egypt. These were people who did everything that the American government demanded of them or asked of them. And then the minute it looked like they were in trouble, we were like, okay, see you later. You know, that is, you know, something that the United States can actually completely control by our actions. We are a bad ally to people. And in that sense, it is good that, you know, Ukraine is going to, you know, survive or not based on the United States. Ultimately, it really is going to be the allies that are directly around it, and countries like France, Germany, and Poland, and other NATO countries that are in the region. And I think they would do better to, you know, kind of work with them and rely on them for assistance. What the U.S. can be doing, and of course, this would be seen as, you know, belligerent actions by the part of Russians. We can help with aid. We can help with refugees and things like that. You know, we're already levying sanctions against them. We're involved. I don't think, I think what we're doing is in the right direction. An escalation of that would be bad for the United States, and I don't think it would necessarily help Ukraine very much. I don't think that the nuclear threat is as, as like front and center as people think. Putin has not shown himself to be insane, it seems highly unlikely that, he's going to pull the trigger, or a rogue general or something within the, you know, the former Soviet Union is going to pull the trigger on things like that. I think, you know, we need to keep it more focused on what's actually happening rather than worrying about that all the time.
So let me just push back.
Hold on. Shush. I would also add just to the notion of the U.S. sending arms into a conflict that involves Russia. That kind of stuff happened scores of times during the Cold War. And sometimes there's not just that, but there were many thousands of American troops fighting against people who were armed and financed by Russia, as happened in the Korean War, and lost a lot of people in that war.
Vietnam as well.
58,000 Vietnam as well. We've been here before, and we managed to avoid nuclear exchange. Go in there, Suderman. Punch Nick in the face.
No, I take the both of your points.
Punch.
We have been here before. We've obviously armed proxy wars, you know, against Russia during the Cold War. At the same time, I want to react to Nick's statement that Putin isn't obviously insane. And it's true that he's not insane, right? He hasn't just behaved bizarrely and erratically necessarily, but he did make, I think, an error of judgment. And it seems clear to me that he is not, that he doesn't fully understand or fully grasp Russia's position in terms of the war in Ukraine. And he thought that, I think along with a lot of Western analysts as well, but he thought that he was going to be able to march in there and take Kyiv quite easily. That turned out not to be true. He thought his military was in much better shape. And Matt, to your point, yes, it's true that we have engaged in proxy wars many, many times before, and it's never resulted in nuclear exchange. But one, just because you've done something risky in the past doesn't proved catastrophic doesn't mean that it won't be catastrophic in the future. And two, it does seem to me that Putin thinks that Russia's approach to the United States during the Cold War was misguided, right? He feels like Russia lost because it didn't take a strong enough position against the United States. And so to me, the risks there are somewhat higher with Putin in charge than they were during the Cold War.
Just very quickly, I think if your presumption is that Putin wants to recreate either a Russian empire or more directly a Soviet empire, and that Ukraine is the beginning of something larger, that's one, you know, one way of thinking about it. But if it's actually
that...
But he hasn't said, I want to go into Poland, I want to go into the Czech Republic and Slovakia, etc.
He said that the Ukraine has
a specific, you know, and it's not a happy one or a good one. And I'm not saying this is a normative statement. It has a different relationship with Ukraine, with Georgia, with Chechnya, with Belarus than it does with other countries in Europe. And I, you know, if his goal is to actually reclaim either direct control or essential control, you know, proxy control of Ukraine as a buffer from Europe, what he's doing actually makes sense. And the Russian army will win this eventually. The question is at what cost? And it may end up that the cost he's not accounting for is the demise of his regime. Sweden and Finland are talking about joining NATO. So, you know, this is not a smart move by him, but by any stretch, but it's also not, you know, totally incomprehensible. So I think it's dangerous when we start to say, look, the guy made a mistake. He screwed up. He must be mad. Did people say that about George W. Bush the minute that Iraq turned into a clusterfuck? Yeah, but and saying that he was, you know, clinically insane and that we need to take him out.
I don't think he's clinically insane.
Yeah.
I do think he is someone who is capable of misjudgments. Certainly
all
arrogance
driven by anger and resentment.
There's a, you know, it's the thing that he wants to restore is more the Soviet Union than it is the Warsaw Pact. I think that's clear, but, let's, you know, that would include the Baltics if the Baltics were not in NATO, which is an interesting thing to think about. Fiona, to give you a semi last word on this, topic, Nick, name checked refugees, and something that you've written about a lot. Just want to get kind of your overall take of where all that is going. There's a word now that Ukrainian refugees are going back into Ukraine in the western part, which is safer than it was before. Joe Biden, who's the president of the United States, announced 10 or so days ago that America is going to accept 100,000. Where do you see refugee policy? What's your analysis of it right now?
Yeah, so just to speak first about the European side of things, I just came from Germany and was kind of scoping out the situation over there. And, you know, Poland's population has grown by something like 6% in recent weeks, right? It's just incredible how many people these countries are taking in. And in Germany, certain trains you're on, certain rooms, certain restaurants, you'll hear more Ukrainian being spoken than German. So there's a really fundamental shift that's happening over there. And the EU is responding in a way that's typically bureaucratic in the way that you would expect, but is also very humanitarian. So they're putting people to work. They're saying if you've fled Ukraine, you can work right away in the country that you've landed in. There are a lot of efforts to get kids into schools, all of these things. On the U.S. side, I think I'm a little more concerned about the actual capacity we have to be doing the things that Biden has said we'll do. He said we'll welcome up to 100,000 refugees, that up to being very important. We really don't have any inkling as to the exact pathways he's going to use, whether they'll be coming through the refugee system, which can take anywhere from 6 to 12 years to process somebody now, given how many people came in through the Afghanistan situation. These sorts of things are still open debates. We resettled 11,000 refugees in the last fiscal year. It's impossible to see that the capacity is going to be there, even though there is this huge support and outpouring that we really don't see in terms of other refugee crises. Americans, by and large, are supportive of these things, and a lot of them would offer their homes willingly, but it really doesn't look like it's likely.
All right, let us shift now with a mixture of reluctance and some disgust and probably a little bit of lulls. To the great groomer debates. We talked on a previous episode or two about the bizarro world confirmation hearings of new Supreme Court Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson, in which Republican senators like Josh Hawley and Ted Cruz could not, for some reason, stop yammering about pedophilia after KBJ received support from just three Republican senators, Mitt Romney, Lisa Murkowski, and Susan Collins. Sure enough, the MAGA-tastic backbencher, Marjorie Taylor Greene, Congresswoman, tweeted out, quote, Murkowski, Collins, and Romney are pro-pedophile. Before we could quite scrape our jaws off the floor on that, the anti-critical race theory activist Christopher Rufo declared war on Disney, which we also talked about a little bit, accusing the House of Mouse last week, especially of intentionally sexualizing and spreading extremist woke propaganda to young children, and also of fostering an atmosphere that harbored or nurtured sexual predators. Suderman, you're from Florida. Is this a case of very online right-wing activists confusing their particular echo chamber with a viable political strategy? Or are Republicans really, really, truly planning to run a campaign in 2022, which they're going to win anyway, on the important issue of combating widespread grooming?
Yeah, I think it's a bunch of people who are way too online. But I also think there's a long history here. And I mentioned this on a previous podcast, but I grew up in the panhandle of Florida, a very conservative, heavily evangelical area. I listened to a lot of Focus on the Family, James Dobson radio, also a lot of NPR, right? I think that's how you end up as a libertarian, is like those are the two poles of your sort of political discourse when you're growing up. But
it's Dr. Gene Scott on the West Coast takes it straight there.
And I actually went back and looked this up before the podcast today, and the Southern Baptist Convention adopted a resolution in 1997 that they were going to boycott Disney. And this was also the American Family Association and all of the kind of conservative Christian evangelical groups. And from 1997 to 2005, they had an official boycott of Disney. And the stated reason, this is a direct quote, was that Disney had increasingly promoting immoral ideologies such as homosexuality, infidelity, and adultery. Right. And notice homosexuality is the first in that list. Right. Because this is just to me a part of the evangelical right's longstanding discomfort and objection to gay rights. And there's a bunch of other stuff that goes on there that is part of this as well. And it has been modernized and run through, you know, sort of like a QAnon filter, right? You know, you have filters on Instagram and it's like the same photo, but it looks just a little bit different after you run it through. So it's like, oh, now I see it in this different light, but it's the same thing. There's a little bit of that stuff that's been mixed in. All the crazy stuff that got talked that Josh Hawley brought up during the Supreme Court Senate hearing. But so much of this just goes back to the fact that the right has always objected to homosexuality, right? To portrayals of it, to the acknowledgement of it, to it's freedom for people to be gay, but also just to kind of sexual freedom and sexual liberation in general. There were scares in the 1980s and 1990s, a big right-wing talking point that occasionally made it into national politics, although wasn't like a presidential level thing, but a big right-wing talking point was that gay teachers were going to abuse kids, and that so they really did not want gay people to be teaching in public schools. And now, of course, we have gay people teaching in public schools, and this has not been like a deep recurring issue that like has turned into like, oh my goodness, this is like, because it's obviously was you know, sort of a scare story that was dreamed up by the conservative religious right. And so I think so much of this is just a modernized version of these old fights about gay rights and about sexual freedom that have always existed between the evangelical right and the left, and the evangelical right's desire to portray all people like to the left of, I don't know, Mitt Romney and maybe Mitt Romney himself as
He's kind a little
as
swish.
As sex perverts,
you know, if we're
right?
talking about it.
And this is, again, this just sort of goes to this right-wing argument that you hear various versions of that I've been hearing all of my life, which is that lefties and progressives and any and coastal elites and people who live in cities, they're all a bunch of perverts, and they're perverts who are coming for your children. And so this is just that again.
Nick, maybe they just learned their lessons from Roy Moore. They've decided to change their ways.
Yeah, it worked out real well for him, right? You know, I don't think Disney and Pixar are helping themselves by announcing that remake of Boys in the Band, Matt. But, you know, so to Peter's point, you know, particularly at the theme parks, you know, Disney, along with a couple of other companies, including, you know, IBM and Levi's in the late 90s, actually extended domestic partnership rules to straight and gay couples. And that's what was that triggering event, you know, for all of these boycotts. The fact of the matter is boycotts generally don't work. I think there may still be technically a boycott in place against table grapes as well as iceberg lettuce. I'm going back to the late 60s and 70s. Yeah. Well, that's because the Sandinistas still are in power, right? In Nicaragua, Matt. That's what kind of triggered that one. But what becomes disturbing now, because, you know, Peter is right that this emanates from a kind of evangelical Christian right script. The evangelical right doesn't really have the troops it used to have. And it has bled out.
They used to advertise themselves even through the George W. Bush era as the single largest voting bloc in the United States. And that's and that was a pitch that they explicitly made to Republican politicians. You have to give us what we want because we are your base.
The point
is, and they masked behind Donald Trump.
Yeah, they don't have the numbers. And the current thing, Chris Rufo is not an evangelical Christian. Marjorie Taylor Greene probably is, but she's much more interested in, you know, kind of space lasers run by the Rothschild family and things like that. So it's a different beast right now, and it is very much tribally. It's Republicans against other Republicans and everybody else. I find it's a kind of sickening turn of events because it is really based on online activism, and it is no longer it's no longer emanating from a from an identifiable source. The thing that is worth talking about, particularly in Florida, I think, is questions to the extent that this extends into school policy and education policy. There is a legitimate concern among parents that they have no idea, you know, and Matt, you can speak to this, given your experience, you know, coming out of COVID especially, and I think this is linked somewhat to COVID in the same way that the response to George Floyd was linked to COVID and people being in lockdown. And normal life being disrupted. But, you know, parents have been jerked around by public schools everywhere in the country, and they are constantly being told that you don't have a right, or they feel like they don't know what's being taught at school. They don't have a right to be what's taught in school. And so the Don't Say Gay bill law now in Florida, you know, part of that was sheer hysteria that, you know, that public schools in Florida, of all places, were grooming children into pansexuality, into transsexuality, into homosexuality, you name it, you know, a true moral panic. But the other part of that was that parents feel, you know, parents don't get to choose what schools their kids go to. And then they're increasingly told, shut the fuck up. You don't get the right to choose what books your kids learn from. You don't get to have a say. And while in many of those instances, I think, you know, the parents would be stupid or make bad choices, the fact is, until we come to that point where we understand, you know, or we have an honest debate, are schools an agent of the state that will educate children the way that the state or, you know, or teachers unions or local school boards want? Or are they an agent of parents? Until we kind of come to, you know, really focus on that, and I think come up with a way where we recognize we need more choice in schools, we're going to have some version of this debate. And assuming that the Republicans take the House and the Senate in the midterms, which is almost certainly going to happen, I wouldn't be surprised if in a year or two we're having this debate and it's progressives attacking the way that public schools are being run now that there is a new Republican regime in power. Because fundamentally, it's a question about, you know, are parents able to kind of condition how their kids learn.
Three quick points suggested by that. One is, I'm just wondering on the fly whether what we've seen is a recurrence of what Peter was talking about. It's kind of a historical line of critique that was almost artificially suppressed for 4 years because the evangelical right masked behind Donald Trump, who was kind of a hard poster child for certain types of morality. So we didn't really talk a whole lot about super moralistic stuff there for a while. And once he was safely gone, you could re-hit those buttons.
Yeah, the Baptist convention opposition to Disney, right? It was for promoting a moral ideology such as homosexuality, infidelity, and adultery. Which,
yeah,
if you're like, and then vote for Donald Trump.
Yeah. Also, to Nick's point, yes, you know, my local school or former local school that we pulled our youngest out of, not for this reason, you know, has a rainbow club in kindergarten. And I can see where some parents in a public school setting might find that a little bit surprising, perhaps inappropriate. If the Florida law was on the books in New York, would probably be illegal, I would one would suppose. And yeah, there are these senses that the kind of progressive social justicization of schools is happening really, really fast, and people only kind of discovered it recently. And then opportunistic activists are like, okay, what do we think is going to frighten them the most to agree with us? Last point I'll make before actually asking Fiona a question is that just to repeat to read a tweet that was the beginning of an interesting thread from a school teacher and a listener to this podcast, Ileana Almog, another damn Romanian American libertarian, saying the groomer debate, just like CRT in schools, No Child Left Behind, busing, desegregation, and the Scopes monkey trial before it, deep cut, is not about what's best for kids. It's about adults fighting over power. It's worth thinking about at least.
Yeah, I think before we go to Fiona, just very quickly, this is also a dividing line between libertarians and conservatives, because the conservative response to all of this is to issue increasingly state-level bans on what is acceptable or what is taught in local schools. You would have expected 10, 20, 30 minutes ago, conservatives to be saying, no, control should be local. Local school board should be making these decisions, but people are trumpeting laws that Ron DeSantis has passed and others, saying at the state level, you cannot teach these texts, you cannot mention them in the classroom, or these ideas or these concepts, or in ways that might make people uncomfortable. That, regardless of the specifics, that is not what conservative governance supposedly stood for. And you see now they are not interested in actually having a lot of different ideas being taught, freedom of expression, things like that. They just want to control the apparatus along the lines that they want. I think the libertarian perspective here, hopefully, is one that will become emergent, and also persuasive and also dominant, which is the point is that the state should not be dictating what is or is not taught pretty much anywhere, even when we're using tax dollars. It should be going to individual parents and kids and creating a system that allows people to have, you know, a lot of different things being taught that reflect the values and meaning, and the kind of life and communities that people inhabit.
Fiona, you were recently a child, and you're part
roughly
of
speaking,
a
you're
part of a generation that Nick and I, for certain, have no idea what you people are like. What is your visceral reaction? Generational reaction when you hear Republican office holders and activists yammer on about this kind of stuff?
You know, I hate to be one of those Bitcoin solves this people, but school choice solves this. I benefited from school
choice.
You
want a groomer token? That's what you want?
I was homeschooled NFT. My whole life, right? I'm a huge beneficiary of you know, homeschooling and school choice and the parental rights to choose what I was being instructed in and where I was being instructed. And to see this kind of big government conservatism, and it's being done under the guise of parental rights in a sense, but it's also robbing parents of the choice to you know, instruct their kids in these things. And to me, even if I've never raised a kid, I've never put a kid through a school. If it's something that I would choose, I would be pissed if I didn't have the option to put my kid in, say, something that prioritized cultural awareness, multiculturalism, these things. Elizabeth Nolan Brown actually wrote a great piece for us, I believe it was last year, about this bill in Wisconsin that would have wholesale banned instruction on 100 words, you know, things that weren't even related to critical race theory, things like hegemony and cultural awareness. And that sort of thing just really upsets me, and it's concerning for me. You know, God forbid I actually have a kid and have to put them through a school that could undergo litigation for teaching on certain things, certain broad terms. I'm happy that I wasn't subject to that. That would have been a bureaucratic hell, and I wonder if there would have actually been any instruction going on. But as somebody who's recently been through school, I'm glad that I don't have to suffer through a public school going through these debates these days.
One thing we should just talk very briefly about the actual bill and the legislation. And like the big problem with this is that it's so vague, and that the Republicans have intentionally made it vague so that they can do whatever they want with it. And Democrats in Florida actually offered an amendment making sure that it would clarifying that the bill would apply to sexual instruction, and Republicans voted it down, which is really, really telling. Right.
Yeah, it isn't vague, though. I mean, it's that they don't want the laws are already in place where you're not doing sex ed. They really don't want any mention of non-binary sexual identity.
It's designed to have a chilling effect on teachers, and to make them scared to talk about a huge range of topics in the classroom.
All right. We're going to get to our listener email of the week here in a moment. But first, are you tired of feeling like someone's always watching you on the internet, even when you think you're using incognito mode? Well, IPVanish VPN is here to protect your right to privacy and help you stay anonymous online. IPVanish enables you to browse safely without exposing your private bits to third parties, whether they be advertisers, ISPs, or hackers. When you use IPVanish on your computer, tablet, phone, Fire Stick, all of your data is encrypted. That means all your private details, passwords, communication, browsing history, Peter, physical location will be completely shielded and without sacrificing your speed. IPVanish makes you virtually invisible online. It really is that simple. Act now, and IPVanish will give Roundtable listeners an incredible 70% off their yearly plan, all with a 30-day money-back guarantee. That's like getting 9 months for free. Just go to ipvanish.com/roundtable and use promotional code roundtable and take your privacy back right now. That is ipvanish.com/roundtable. Do it today. You'll be glad you did. All right, reminder, please email your queries to the gang at roundtable@reason.com. This one comes from RV, who writes, "Can a tent be too big?" I think he had a... Can a tent be too big, dude? I understand the definition of libertarianism is fluid, but there has to be limits to that. Anytime someone tries to nail down a few ideas, it's always countered with them saying, "No true Scotsman fallacy," or "Libertarianism is the goal, but we need to be pragmatic in the short term." All of this, however, is a convoluted way for me to say the LP, Libertarian Party, of NH, New Hampshire, the Mises Caucus, and last week's roundtable emailer are not libertarian and should stop using the word. DeSantisistas, meaning Ron DeSantis peoples, Trumpers, pro-Putin trad cons, and all right-wing reactionaries need to be disavowed and loudly. All right, Nick, this is a perennial question. So how are you responding to that one this year?
To the letter writer or?
The question of should we be saying out loud and proud, that person over there saying they're libertarian, they're not.
Yeah.
You get out of this tent.
Yeah, I mean, what I do, and I don't think I'm shy about this, is like if I don't understand why somebody is saying they're libertarian based on their beliefs, you know, I ask what's going on. I mean, for me, The biggest thing about a lot of stuff coming out of the Mises Caucus or the LP New Hampshire or other groups is the emphasis on being anti-immigration or saying, like, and I simply don't understand this, and I don't understand why they want to call themselves libertarian. But if you are, you know, I get accused a lot of not being a true libertarian because I'm not a narco-capitalist. But I don't understand people who say I'm an anarchist, but the state should absolutely, you know, in a very draconian fashion, police the perimeter of the United States, which shouldn't exist. The South had every right to secede, blah, 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 you know, and that we should have a maximum army around our border to make sure that people don't come into the country. But after that, everything is laissez-faire. I don't understand. That doesn't square with any definition of libertarian that I understand or you know, kind of favor. So whether or not there's a tent that is too big, that's an interesting question. I don't belong to the Libertarian Party. I belong to the Libertarian Movement. And to the extent that we start getting lumped in with a bunch of people who are racist, who are nasty in a way that turns off anybody who doesn't already agree with them, that's a real problem. And I'm trying to, you know, I've been trying it all of my time at Reason, and I'm sure after my time at Reason, I'll be pushing to have a vision of libertarian ideas and a libertarian America that's persuasive and attractive and inclusive. But yeah, you can't be a racist. I don't think you can be a racist and be a libertarian. I don't think there's much to, you know, to discuss about that.
Nick, there is no after your time at Reason.
Yeah, I know.
I understand this.
Believe me, I've got the kill switch. You know, when I don't even think about getting rid of me, Matt.
Suderman, you obviously don't want the tent to be any smaller because then immediately you'd be outside, right?
I'm for a tent big enough to fit all of my dogs, which means a really, really big tent. So look, people are going to call themselves whatever they want to call themselves. And to some extent, those definitions and then the inevitable fights over them, to some extent, they're useful. And to some extent, I sort of find them tedious because you can't escape them and you can't stop someone from calling themselves whatever it is they want to call themselves. Like Nick, however, I certainly don't want libertarianism to be associated with racism and bigotry and sort of just awful, awful ideas that I think sometimes, do get associated with the brand. But notice that those are ideas. And so this is why, in general, I prefer to describe and categorize ideas as libertarian rather than asking whether specific people or groups are libertarian. Because to me, it's about the ideas and the direction those ideas would take us. And there are libertarian ideas, sometimes libertarian ideas that are held by people who are not libertarians. But it's the ideas that are important. And to me, that's what I want to focus on most, rather than the infighting about which specific individual actually is a libertarian and holds the rights to call themselves or call other people libertarians or not libertarians.
Fiona, you were recently at college. Does this just all sound Greek to you, given the total number of libertarians, I presume, at college, which might fit in a phone booth?
Yeah, I can't say at the University of Arizona we were dealing in too many nuanced labels of libertarians. and being a recent college grad, I don't know as much about libertarian history as I should. But, you know, my gut reaction is that a tent is kind of doomed to be big if it, intends to do anything politically as a political movement. There are people who come to libertarianism for all sorts of reasons, whether it's school choice or because they like smoking weed or et cetera, et cetera. It has to be a personal thing, right? And being a comparatively small political organization, you kind of have to deal with uncomfortable bedfellows if you want to get anything done electorally. So that's part of why I call myself more a little L libertarian than a big L libertarian. I'm happy to impose any number of personal litmus tests, and I come close to Nick on those things, saying if you're anti-immigration, you're anti-free association in a sense, right? Those sorts of things. If you want to make the state bigger for an element that you see unsavory, then I don't consider you a libertarian. But whether it's worthwhile in the electoral sense to keep people out, I think that's a question that I don't tend to deal in super often, and it's something that isn't really as relevant to my brand of libertarianism.
I took the approach during my editorship when these kinds of questions would come up, that it, to not play the role of libertarian nomenclature cop, which was not not even a dodge, although I, you know, my question to Suderman applies to me as well. Usually, whatever hyper litmus test one might approach libertarianism would throw me in the outside of it, depending on who's giving it and for what reason. But also, just not interested in playing the ideological policeman in any direction. And it's also kind of consistent with Reason's own intellectual history. If you read the oral history that Brian Doherty put together for our 2008 40th anniversary issue, there was a moment in the early 70s when Reason was covering a lot of Libertarian Party formation and discussion and controversies, and I think even broke it out into a sort of a newsletter. And lo and behold, what happened when they started like talking about intra-libertarian disputes? Everyone was just fuming at each other all the time, because that's one thing that libertarians are excellent at doing, is getting super mad and saying that you're not libertarian and no, you're not libertarian. And so it was kind of a defining moment for the magazine. They made the conscious decision, well, you know what we want to do? We want to be an outreach magazine. We want a sense of broad libertarian anchoring. And our audience isn't necessarily the hardest of hardcore libertarians. We want them all to read, and they will, and they will contribute as well. But we also want to produce a magazine, which is that's all it was back then. And we do all these other things that is palatable to a broader audience of people, including people who are not libertarian, and to make it worthy of kind of engagement on that level. And so it seems to me that a lot of people who engage, who are in either media or activism, who do appoint themselves to be libertarian policemen, there's a lot of opportunism that comes from that. You know, a sense of competition against other organizations, a way to kind of differentiate yourself in the market. And that's all fine. Go with God, go with Ayn Rand, whatever. But it's never been something that was particularly interesting to me. The end. Okay, let's go to our end of podcast, what we have been consuming in a cultural way. Peter, why don't you lead us off?
I watched Apollo 10 and a Half, A Space Age Childhood. This is the new movie by Texas filmmaker Richard Linklater. Like several of his films, it's an animated movie, but it's animated over the top of live action photography. So he actually shot the movie on digital film first and then drew over it. So it has this sort of hazy, memory laden kind of fantasy vibe, which fits, because in many ways it's sort of very grounded and down to earth, cultural. Really specific tale of a particular time and place, and at the same time, there's also a fantasy aspect, because it's about a kid who is growing up in the shadow of the Houston space program at the dawn of the, you know, the space era, and his dad works for NASA, but as like a procurement specialist, right? So in one way, he's really deeply taking part in the, you know, in the moonshot. And in another way, his job is just to like move boxes of metals from this spot to that spot. And right, it's like not exactly all that glamorous, but it gave him this sort of great, comfortable Texas middle-class childhood, right? There's a lot of like shots of like the new, you know, suburbs that are springing up, you know, with all these cookie cutter houses. And it's kind of idyllic and kind of nostalgic. But it's also, it's really sweet and clever and interestingly specific in a way that I think too few movies are these days, right? Because it's very much focused on this one particular time and place. And it reaches back nostalgically to the dawn of the space age, and tries to place the moonshot in America's historical identity, right? It suggests like, look, this was a time in which there was a lot of new technology coming online. There's a whole just like a 5-minute bit about the Astrodome and AstroTurf that doesn't really have anything to do with the rest of the movie, except that it's like AstroTurf gave us hope for the future, man, because that was the future and we were living in it. The Astrodome. Wow. Can you believe it?
Dude, just to
yeah,
to
you probably have more feelings about AstroTurf than I do.
To underscore, I do. They're deep. I have AstroTurf in my front patio here. We're a pro AstroTurf family. No, the last, until the Cleveland Indians changed their name to the Guardians, the last name change in Major League Baseball was the Houston Astros was changed from the Colt 45s, literally went from old ye old West six shooters and Yosemite Sam and that kind of stuff to like, no, dude, we're about space in the future. Go on.
Yeah. So look, I know libertarians have a lot of mixed feelings about NASA and, you know, big government programs. But the movie does actually end with at least some acknowledgement that one of the big complaints at the time, whether the sort of a school of criticism against the moonshot, was that it cost an awful lot of money just to send, you know, I think it ended up being 12 dudes to step on the moon for a couple of minutes each, right? And then it just sort of says, you know what? Gave us all hope. It's probably worth doing. This is a great thing and seems to like suggest we should probably go back. It's a charming movie about hope and about the future and the way technology and doing big things inspires people. And it's just a wonderful, wonderful watch.
As someone who grew up in similarly situated circumstances, I think that sounds like a fascinating thing. But also, I think add that one of the reasons why we can't get away from the moonshot as a metaphor, I think I wrote a piece like more than a decade ago for Reason By Now called Goodnight Moonshot, really good headline, we have to admit, is that people have nostalgia less for the moment, which is fading from memory. Thankfully, this has come out, but more for the feeling of we mobilized everything towards this goal, and mobilization itself is great. And it's not great. If you go back and read the John F. Kennedy speech, which is very brief about—
And you see snippets in the movie, yeah.
Why we need to go to the moon. It's filled with stuff like, look, we are going to be diverting productive capital away from the private sector. And that kind of sucks. We're going to be retarding development when we do that. And also, if we're going to do this, you know, there has to be zero labor disputes. So get out of the way, unions. I mean, it's like it was very crude, blunt force. And, you know, we don't do anything big and spectacular anymore. It's only private companies. I'm just saying that because Catherine's not here.
Yeah, Nick, what did you now consider? I was going to say also, when you think of the amount of money wasted on the Houston Astros for, you know, 40 years plus, really, it was an even emptier gesture of grandness than going to the moon.
That's spoken like Enos Cabell.
Or, you know, Cesar Cedeno. I'm curious, Matt, why was Jimmy Wynn still referred to as the toy cannon? Why wasn't his nickname put into some kind of space talk if they were getting rid of the old West?
The toy space laser.
Space elevator, retro rocket, the, you know, something like that. And that concludes our callback to the, you know, to the old baseball playing crew that might be listening to this if they aren't deaf yet.
I got some feedback in Nashville. Like, there's at least one listener out there here for 1970s baseball.
Who's there for the random Ray Sadecki sighting and things like that?
I heard from people who liked all the Marvel Universe talk. So I'm just
you were talking to yourself, Peter. You were too deep in your cups.
But speaking of cups, Nick, what did you consume?
Yeah, so what I read, and let me just call up the full name of it, it's Chaos Theory, Finding Meaning in the Madness, One Bad Decision at a Time by Leah McSweeney, who is a member of the Real Housewives of New York cast. She created a streetwear fashion brand called Married to the Mob, which is very funny and very literally and figuratively bitchy and feminist all at the same time. And this is a memoir about her addictions, various addictions, her sex life, her mental illness, and kind of her, at least for the moment, triumph over all of that. She's a very interesting, you know, character. She co-wrote a piece a few years ago for Tablet Magazine that essentially ended the Women's March as a force in American life because she detailed the rank anti-Semitism at the very center of that action. She's great. She's fascinating. She is kind of like if you took Helen Gurley Brown's liberated type woman or the Cosmo girl, really liberate her. And that's who she is right now. She talks very frankly about boozing, about drugging, about sex, about being on a reality TV show, and also about making it in business. Chaos Theory is a fun, interesting read about a figure who there's a lot to learn from, both good and bad. So I read Chaos Theory, Finding Meaning in the Madness, One Bad Decision at a Time by Leah McSweeney, and I think most people would very much enjoy that that experience.
Nice. Fiona Harrigan, what did you consume?
I'm coming in with Father John Misty's new album, Chloe in the Next 20th Century. I've liked Father John Misty for a while. He had this intro as an unpretentious folk singer and drummer for Fleet Foxes, and then established this quasi-douchebag, old Hollywood-type image. And that's kind of what's on display here. It's a really, really interesting album, though. Some really interesting, cool vintage overtones, breaks into bossa nova at one point, a lot of big band stuff and orchestral overtones. And it's a really cool album. I find it to be pretty vague and a little customizable for the individual listener, more so than his earlier albums, which were a lot of love albums and individual angst. But this one feels like something that's very Western, very old Hollywood in a way that I've never experienced, but it's cool to do it vicariously, and I miss the West Coast, and it feels like glitzy West Coast that I wish I could experience.
It's kind of funny. I've also been listening to this album a whole bunch, and this guy started as like a sort of folk crooner who, with like a really ironic sort of like elder millennial worldview that was like, man, Facebook is just messing me up. But like at the same time, also like funny about that, like understanding how, like what a ridiculous thing to complain about that is. And what he's done here is like you talked about some of this a little bit, but he has gone back to the well, not like of the 1970s, which is what he was always pulling from before, but as of like 40s Sinatra, like Vegas-y, Rat Pack, big band sort of, right? And somehow or another, he's like, he has transcended like millennial irony somehow. And he's in some zone that's way past it that I can't even categorize.
Yeah, he's playing chess, not checkers anymore.
It's like he's in a new dimension that's like, that is both fully ironic and fully earnest all at once. And I don't know that I love the album, although there's bits that I think are really wonderful. But I'm just impressed with the way he has managed the tonal shift here, because I don't think I've ever heard a modern artist like reach back, you know, a modern sort of folk pop indie artist reach back to this stuff as deeply and as fully as he has. He's actually going to be touring with a full symphony, and I'm going to go see him in a couple of months.
Yep, same here.
He gives off really, I mean, apropos of our earlier conversations, to me, he gives off massive groomer vibes. He is like the biggest groomer coming out of folk since Peter Yarrow of Peter, Paul, and Mary.
Every time I see photos of him, I'm just like, I want to hashtag them beard goals.
the only groomer in music, Nick, as you well know, is John Phillips. Let's move on. Speaking of music, though, I consumed by visiting and touring the Ryman Auditorium in Nashville, Tennessee. Ryman Auditorium is the church of country music. Literally, it was built as a church in the late or in the
1850s.
No,
The original building dates from 1851, doesn't it? No, maybe not. I withdraw the suggestion.
Don't think so. But anyways, it was the house of the Grand Ole Opry from the 1940s to the 1970s. And you can tour around the auditorium. It's really striking visually because it's kind of cramped in. It seats, I don't know, maybe 2,000 people, but the balcony overhangs like pretty aggressively.
Is that because people were smaller back then?
People were smaller. No, it's built. It's a place that's really, really famous for its acoustics. Peter, you should pay attention to that. You like that kind of crap. Designed to help preachers and choirs to project their voices maximally. And it's like just the curves of it, the wood, hard wooden pews. Just a great place, and especially fun. And this is true both at the Ryman Auditorium and at the Country Music Hall of Fame, which we all toured. So they have different little exhibits of the people who've played there. And it's usually like, here's the instruments. Maybe here's a poster, the Great Hatch posters. And more importantly to me, and the most spectacular thing is, here's the costume. Here is the crazy glittery costume, the nudie suit that, you know, Dolly Parton wore, or whoever the hell wore. And it's just lovely and great. And it's very fun. Easy little visit in downtown Nashville. It warms your heart, and it's
a wonderful city to visit, for sure.
It's a wonderful, and especially if you're one of the 75 different bachelorette parties that are taking place. Yep.
In Holy live cow. View, in kind of bubbles. It's almost as if the Adolf Eichmann chamber for his trial in Israel, it's just now those are elongated and filled with increasingly drunk bachelorette parties on full display, and yet impervious from weaponry, I suspect.
I think that there's a feminist read on this, Nick, which is that 50 years ago, it would be the Rolling Stones on a flatbed truck going through Manhattan with playing from their Black and Blue record, which had some pretty disturbing iconography.
What are you and now talking you about? Have. They're just waiting on a friend, Matt.
Now you have
not waiting like, on a lady,
15 gals on a transparent truck, just absolutely whooping it up at Bon Jovi at the top of their lungs, wasted at 11:30 on a weekday morning. It's pretty fantastic. But anyways, Ryman Auditorium, super great.
Which is 1892, by the way. I am totally mistaken, Matt Welch. As
it
often
happens, is. Even to the greats such as Nick Gillespie, speaking of which, you can listen to the great Nick Gillespie on the Wednesday, or the recent interview with Nick Gillespie on Wednesdays.
Now featuring Nick Gillespie, yes.
Yes. I can't wait for the Spider-Man interview of
yes,
Nick Gillespie,
right.
Pointing at Nick Gillespie and dueling Biff Pokoroba references. But go to all our podcast stuff, including the Soho Forum debate series with Gene Epstein, at reason.com/podcasts. And if you like anything that we do at all at the Reason Foundation, journalism, public policy, go to reason.com/donate. You can even donate on a recurring basis, like the kids do nowadays, so I hear. Okay, that's all the time that we have. Thank you, Fiona Harrigan. Please clap, everyone. Well done.
Thank you.
Subbing in for Catherine, who may or may not be back if we let her back. We have to have a meeting about
that. Yeah, I
think
we need to have a recalculation after Fiona's appearance.
That's true. Well, we'll see who gets fired next, Nick. Okay, we will catch you next Monday, and thank you.